From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Beyond the Seventh Gate, an amazing story of strangeness. Wow, wait till you hear it. Here's what's happening and what a night this has been. First of all, is there life on Jupiter's moon Europa? NASA will announce a major news breakthrough at a press conference on Monday. We will cover it for you. We'll have the information Monday night. Could be an amazing story. Here's what's happening. Protests turning to violence for a second night in Charlotte, North Carolina, after Tuesday's fatal police shooting of a black man by a black police officer. Now, late Wednesday, the governor out there declared a state of emergency for the city and deployed the National Guard and the State Highway Patrol troopers to assist local police. One person was shot at the protest by a civilian and was taken to the hospital with life-threatening injuries. That person's in critical condition. The city initially thought the person had died, but they retracted that story. This has been a tense situation for the last two nights in Charlotte, North Carolina, all over this shooting. And this is basically what happened. Individual got out of his SUV brandishing a gun. Police were there because they were there to serve a warrant on somebody else. He happened to be in the area. He got out of the SUV. He had the gun in his hand, and police several times asked the individual to put the gun down. He kept walking. They did it again. Put the gun down. He did not. And even witnesses saw this. Finally, they opened fire on him and killed him. I don't know why police and people are so tense. Just put your gun down. That's all you have to do. And I do want to say this in support of our police officers all around this country, and many of whom listen to this program at night when they are on night duty. We support you, men and women out there. You give your lives on the line every night for us. You shouldn't have to go through this. I'm sure when you woke up in the morning, put your vest on, you didn't anticipate having to shoot somebody. That's not what your intent is. Now, there's no question there have been some episodes of police using violence to extremes. Tulsa, Oklahoma might have been one of those. But in this particular case, you don't go walking around with a handgun in the air and police are practically begging for you to put it down. And then the biggest problem is parents out there in Charlotte, North Carolina, most of the kids I've seen on television over the last night or two are young kids. Rein your kids in and get them home. I don't get it. These kids are running lawless all over the place, and it's out of control. Looting, that's not protesting. Breaking windows, fires, that's not protest. And why doesn't anybody come forward to say, the guy had a gun, put it down? Even that tragedy that occurred some time ago, the little boy came at police with a toy gun. Well, they don't know it's a toy gun. It had a laser on it. They kept asking him, put it down, put it down. He kept pointing it at them. They had to open fire, too. People have got to realize you cannot do this. Let's go on to some other stories here. ISIS fighters are believed to have attacked U.S. and Iraqi forces with a chemical weapon. The U.S. base, which is 25 miles south of Mosul, came under rocket fire, and traces of a mustard agent were believed to be present. That's a first. You know, we've been covering all kinds of stories of illness and viruses. Listen to this one now. Before dinner on July 29, a three-year-old little boy, Carter Roberts of Chesterfield, Virginia, seemed perfectly healthy. That evening, he got very sick. He vomited. When he woke up the next morning, he had a slight fever. His mother figured that he was coming down with a cold. The next morning, she found him collapsed on the bedroom floor. He was mimicking, "Mommy, Mommy, help me." He could barely stand up when she picked him up. Took him to the hospital. He lost control of his right arm, then his legs and other muscles within a few days. He now can only wiggle a toe and move the left side of his face. He's been diagnosed with a mysterious polio-like illness, a condition they say that seems to be surging this year, and they don't know what it is. And also allegations made by the government that birth defects in the Americas are caused by the Zika virus are quickly waning now. Doctors in Brazil are quietly acknowledging that Zika may not be responsible for causing birth defects after all. John Rappaport, the great investigator, has been saying that, and I thought we'd bring him in for a moment. John, what is it if it's not the Zika virus?
Well, first of all, George, as you said, the consensus is falling apart. They jumped the gun. They went overboard with this whole Zika fantasy on the basis of no proof. So now as they backtrack, other doctors in Brazil have been saying for a while it was a pesticide or a combination of pesticides. And in fact, in Miami, where, as you know, they started spraying a chemical to kill the so-called Zika-carrying mosquitoes, the chemical pesticide is called Nalid. Mm-hmm. If you look that one up, you see that it can indeed cause birth defects.
Uh-huh.
So look to the pesticides, possible vaccine as well in Brazil, but this is not where the medical people want to go. They want to stick with the virus, but that consensus is vanishing as we speak.
Well, you keep up the good work, John, and let's get you back for a larger show, okay?
Thank you, George. Right. Sure.
John Rappaport website linked up at our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Well, you know, we've always heard that stress can kill, right? Now they say stress can cancel out the benefits of a healthy diet. That's absolutely right. So if you're on a diet trying to lose weight or to get in shape, and if you're under stress, it's not going to happen. The family of JonBenet Ramsey has threatened to sue CBS over the case of JonBenet Ramsey for suggesting that the little beauty queen's brother was her killer. A lawyer for the Ramsey family says the documentary is riddled with lies, misrepresentations, distortions, omissions. Burke Ramsey was 9 years old when his six-year-old sister JonBenet was found dead in the basement of their family's Boulder, Colorado home in December 26, 1996. Public suspicion immediately focused on the girl's parents, John and Patsy Ramsey, and possibly Burke. My old friend Charlie Bosworth Jr. wrote a book called Who Killed JonBenet Ramsey? And Charlie, I don't know if we're pulling you out of retirement or what, but this is a story that just won't go away.
It's fascinating, George, that almost 20 years later, you and I are still talking about this.
We really are. Now, you've had your own theories and your own conclusions, but let's talk about Burke for a second, who apparently is going to sue CBS. He's very close to that because they really pointed the finger at him. What do you think?
Well, they certainly did. I was, I've been doing some traveling, so I haven't been able to catch all of the episodes of the recent shows. I did catch the final 2 hours of the CBS presentation, and I have to say I was beyond startled, probably astounded when they did so boldly assess the evidence as pointing directly at Burke. As you know, and we've talked about many times, my co-author and I, Cyril Wecht, the world-renowned pathologist and former coroner from Allegheny County in Pittsburgh, Cyril, and he and I spoke briefly today about it. He was of the conclusion that that Burke was unlikely to have been involved in it because there were so many other factors that were beyond the abilities of a nine-year-old boy, from the garrote, which was mm-hmm. a fairly sophisticated and very devious device, and of course to the ransom note. But I thought the CBS program and the experts there tied all of that together in, you know, in a very, very interesting manner. And, you know, in their defense, this is theory. It's hypothesis. Despite the Ramsey's attorney's Lynn Wood's typically hyperbolic letter threatening to sue, there probably is a legal question about whether John Ramsey and Burke Ramsey are at this point the kind of public figures that make them susceptible to this kind of speculation, this kind of theory, without legal recourse. The law has always held that a public figure has to be able to prove that statements made against them were made either knowing that they were false or with a reckless disregard for the truth of the statements. And I think in this case, that would be a very, very hard burden to carry in the courtroom. But obviously, Mr. Wood is experienced at this. He's been representing the Ramseys for many years and through a number of lawsuits. So it'll be very interesting to see how this works out from this point.
Charlie, what will it take to get to the bottom of this murder case and finally find out what happened?
Absent a confession, George, I don't know that there's any way to do it.
No.
You've had A&E take a long, detailed look at the case. You've had now CBS, and of course that comes on the heels of like we just said, 20 years of analysis by everybody you can think of, with the kind of minds involved like Dr. Henry Lee and John Douglas, the former FBI profiler, and my co-author Cyril Wecht, who. And I'm certainly biased here, but I think Cyril operates at so close to a genius level as to be astounding. I don't know that absent a confession that this can ever be solved. The evidence has been looked at up and down and back and forth, and as we just saw, that you can use it to come to almost any conclusion that you want to. You can argue the case from any particular side. And as much as Cyril and I went through the case, our book was published in 1998, and you know, as much as we went through the case, we've always talked about, you know, we could play devil's advocate and almost argue any kind of theory you wanted to. We came down on the side of there not being an intruder, and that this being something that happened internally in the family. But again, that was a theory that we put forth based on the evidence, and certainly there have been a lot of developments since we did our investigation in 97 and 98. So I just don't know, Georgia. We've talked this over so many times, and I don't know how you prove a case like this. And of course, Alex Hunter, whose work I've always found to be very unconvincing, you know, there was an indictment, there were true bills that the grand jury returned that Alex Hunter refused to sign or to prosecute against John and Patsy Ramsey for what would have been accessory after the fact kind of allegations. And Alex said that there was not enough evidence to prove those cases in court, therefore he wouldn't even sign the indictments, which raises legal questions about whether a prosecutor can even do that given a grand jury true bill. But again, you've got prosecutors, and Alex Hunter is certainly an experienced prosecutor, and he said, you know, there's not even enough evidence to prove that John and Patsy Ramsey intentionally interfered with the investigation in order to prevent the prosecution of a guilty party.
Charlie, it's good to hear from you again, too. Thank
you, George. Anytime.
All right, my friend. Charlie Bosworth, his book, Who Killed John Bennet Ramsey? A couple months ago, when I was in Boulder, Colorado, taping our Beyond Belief television programs, I had our driver take me by the home where this occurred. And I got to tell you, from the outside, you could actually feel the sadness from that house, the eeriness, knowing what happened there way back a long time ago. It was very strange. Bob Mitchell, a Canadian author, journalist, who was just on with me talking about the John Teeter time traveler story, has died in his battle of cancer. He will be missed. The Senate is taking a closer look right now at a proposed $66 billion merger of the American seed and weed killer company Monsanto and the German medicine and farm chemical maker Bayer. The deal combines two of the six U.S. and European companies that dominate the agrochemical market and would create a global agricultural and chemical giant with a broad array of products. What will happen? Well, we're going to go live to Germany in a moment. F. William Engdahl with us back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. F. William Engdahl has specialized for more than 30 years in geopolitical analysis of global events. After a degree in politics from Princeton University and graduate study at the University of Stockholm, he worked as an independent economist and research journalist in New York, later in Europe as well. He was with me not too long ago as we talked about seeds of destruction, the hidden agenda of genetic manipulation. And tonight we're going to be talking about this incredible merger, this possibility of Monsanto and Bayer. And William, you are in Germany right now where Bayer is headed. Kind of ironic.
That's right.
So
that's right. I'm about 2 hours car drive away from Leverkusen, where the Bayer World headquarters is situated.
What do you think of this planned merger?
I think it's a ghastly catastrophe for the world and for agriculture and for the security of the food chain. If the U.S. Congress lets this one go through, there's no such thing as antitrust laws when it comes to certain prized multinational corporations. Bayer Monsanto would give the world 31% or almost one-third of the total agrochemical market. And the agrochemicals that Bayer produces, these are called neonicotinoids, like nicotine in the cigarette. They are systemic central nervous system killers that are responsible, according to scientific research studies, for the bee colony deaths that were so rampant a few years ago, until the European Union banned neonicotinoids for 3 years. It's still under ban right now. And the songbirds are coming back and the bees are thriving and so forth. But until that happened, the bee colonies across Europe, Germany and so forth, were just vanishing. So that's one thing. Monsanto is in deep, deep trouble in the last 3-4 years. It's become synonymous with the evil corporate governance, if you want to call it something. The genetic manipulated seed monopolies, the patents that they have, the patents they hold on Terminator seeds from Delta and Pineland in Mississippi that they bought up a few years ago. And they had to do something. So Bayer, in a friendly takeover, swallowed Monsanto, and the Monsanto brand name is going to vanish, but not the horrible things that Monsanto's agrochemicals like glyphosate, Roundup, and so forth are doing to the human food chain, the animal food chain. And now Bayer is going to add its pesticide neonicotinoids onto this, and it's going to be a deadly combination. I think it's alarming to the first degree.
Is this going to be a slam dunk merger, or are they going to have some problems going through regulatory agencies?
Given the political clout, Bayer is, keep in mind, Bayer used to be part of IG Farben, which was the Nazi chemical cartel during World War II.
Uh-huh.
And worked closely with the Rockefeller Standard Oil Group under behind the curtains to feed the German war machine against the Soviet Union. Bayer has enormous political clout in the European Union, enormous, through Germany. And they have somehow managed to create a squeaky clean image, you know, these little aspirin pills that you take when you get a headache and whatnot. That's what people's image of Bayer is. But in reality, it's what I said, the neonicotinoids, these are some of the deadliest poisons that are out there, and Bayer is the one pushing them. And they're still allowed in the United States, the neonicotinoids of Bayer. So I think it's unlikely, given the corruption of politics in Washington today, it's unlike, and the influence of Monsanto, it's unlikely that they're going to throw up a red flag and say this is too much a concentration a cartel concentration of power. 31% by Bayer Monsanto. Syngenta Chem China in the recent merger has almost 30%. And DuPont and Dow have merged. So you have three companies with almost 75% of the global market of agrochemicals.
It's huge. William, we're going to take a quick break, but we're going to come back and talk more about world events through your eyes. Your new book is out called The Lost Hegemon. We'll get into that as well. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We'll take calls with William next hour. I've got so much to talk with him about. William Engdahl with us in Germany. What are you doing in Germany, by the way, William?
Well, I came here about 30 years ago to as a journalist, and one thing led to another, and it's a fairly convenient perch to kind of watch what's going on in the world.
Oh, my God, yeah.
A couple of hours away from Moscow and about 9 hours away from Beijing, where I was about a month ago. And, of course, all of Europe you have within a stone's throw. So it's a useful place, and it's a comfortable place for me. So that's kind of how it developed.
When I was much younger, and I would hear news stories about things happening abroad, Europe, China, Soviet Union then, I didn't think much about it. I just said, it doesn't affect me here in the United States. And The older I got, I realized how wrong I was as a kid, that these events worldwide affect all of us. All of us, don't they?
Yeah. Well, you see the appalling lack of truth in the mainstream media, what's happened to the New York Times or the Washington Post since the Iraq War in 2003 makes your hair stand on end. It's just, there's not even a semblance of truth anymore. It's just propaganda and run out of the Pentagon in most cases these days. So to get a perspective on how the rest of the world sees what's going on coming out of Washington and so forth is, I think, extremely valuable for me as an American looking at the world and what Washington is doing in the world, which certainly isn't to the good these days.
Would you say that the Iraq War, outside of going in to try to, you know, save Kuwait at that time in 91, but that the Gulf War of 2003 was a disaster?
Complete catastrophe. Yes. The background to the Bush-Cheney 2003 Gulf War was not as we know now, and we knew then, but nobody listened because the propaganda machine was so highly active. There were no weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein was anything but a threat to the United States, national security, or anything else. The country was on its back from the U.S. sanctions, the no-fly zone, etc. But it was part of a plan, and General Wesley Clark mentioned this in a speech some years ago, but it was a part of a Pentagon plan, a Cheney plan, that goes back to 1999 when Dick Cheney, the CEO of Halliburton, the world's largest oil field services company, and he talked about the Middle East, where the prize ultimately lies for the largest untapped oil reserves in the world that are going to be necessary to feed the world economy over the next decades. And he said the problem with the Middle East is that the oil is in the hands of state governments, state-owned oil companies, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Libya, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, lo and behold, after 9/11, and the storyline was that Osama bin Laden from some cave in Tora Bora in Afghanistan was orchestrating these death-defying events in the World Trade Towers and the Pentagon and so forth through, I don't know what, a tin can on a string or something. Well, suddenly Americans forgot in their traumatized state of the shock, I guess, and the storyline turned to Saddam Hussein, who has nothing to do with Osama bin Laden, who despises the jihadist Salafism of Saudi Arabia. And we took out Iraq. Then we, a few years later, came to something called the Arab Spring when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, and she backed this idea of regime change throughout the Arab oil world, starting with Tunisia, Egypt, and then Libya. And then it comes out in the emails of Hillary's with Sidney Blumenthal, her private consultant and lawyer, that one of the reasons for the U.S. knocking out Gaddafi was the fact that Gaddafi, Mubarak in Egypt, and Ben Ali, the president then of Tunisia, were in the process of forming a gold-backed dinar. Listen to this very carefully.
Right. Instead of a dollar, right? Instead of the dollar.
Yeah, a gold-backed dinar. In other words, return of gold backing to currencies, which the U.S. abandoned in 1971 for paper money that you can print in infinite supply as long as the world has no alternative but to swallow your dollars. So that was the real reason, among other things, that Gaddafi's head was put on a spike by Hillary Clinton.
Is that why we're going, William, is that why we're going after Assad in Syria as well? Or is that a different reason?
Well, no, the Assad in Syria, it's about oil and gas as well. And what it goes back to is 2009. At that point, Qatar, which is essentially a U.S. military base, Doha, but Qatar, the Sheikh of Qatar, went to Damascus and had a meeting with Bashar al-Assad, said, Qatar, which has one of the largest gas fields in the world, in the Persian Gulf, they want to tap into the huge European Union natural gas market, and they proposed a pipeline going from Qatar across Syria, across Turkey, into the European Union to capture that market. Well, Bashar al-Assad said, thank you, no, because we have a very long-standing and a very good relationship with Russia and with Gazprom, and we work with them on our pipeline issues. And about 2 years later, a year and a half later, Bashar al-Assad, together with the government of Iraq and the government of Iran, came to an agreement to build a pipeline from the Iranian side. This is a huge gas formation that crosses the international territorial waters between Qatar and Iran, if you look at a map. And the Iranian side of this huge gas field would go by pipeline through Iraq and then through Syria onto Lebanon and to the European market. So essentially, at that point, when that agreement was made public, U.S. gave the green light. Saudi Arabia gave the money, Qatar gave the money, the Muslim Brotherhood did the dirty work, trained in Turkey at that time on secret NATO bases to create the terrorism, essentially to create the terrorism to simply destroy Bashar al-Assad and begin carving up the country for these pipelines.
Well,
so
and it's,
in that sense, the Syria war is a pipeline war.
And it's the terrorism that still exists today. I am so confused, William, about what's going on in Syria in terms of who we're supporting and who we are not. Who's in there? I've heard, for example, that we support ISIS in Syria to get Assad out. But is this the same ISIS that we think we're fighting every place else?
Yeah. It's so hypocritical. I wrote a book. My latest book is called The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy. And what I describe is more than 50 years of intimate collaboration and weaponization by the CIA, by U.S. intelligence, military intelligence, and so, of Islamic terrorism, of terrorism with an Islamic disguise. And it starts, it goes back to Afghanistan in the 80s and the Mujahideen. That's something that Zbigniew Brzezinski set on fire with CIA money. And that was used to destroy the Soviets in Afghanistan and drive them out, their so-called Vietnam, after 10 years.
That's right.
And then the Mujahideen were taken by the CIA after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, 1990. They were flown in on CIA private airlines into the leading people into Azerbaijan because British Petroleum and ARCO, Atlantic Richfield, wanted to control the oil riches of Baku in Azerbaijan, which had declared independent from the Soviet Union. And then they brought them into Chechnya. You remember the Chechen wars in the 90s?
That's right.
During Yeltsin's term. Well, those were Mujahideen recruited by Osama bin Laden for the CIA, for Saudi intelligence in Afghanistan, and then brought into Chechnya to make holy hell, because there was a pipeline running from Baku in the old Soviet times, an oil pipeline going through Chechnya, which is part of the Russian Federation today and was then, into the world oil market through Russia. And the British and the U.S. wanted to destroy that pipeline, and they used Osama bin Laden's terrorists to do that. That was called the Chechen War, or wars. There were two of them.
It's just amazing that it's all over oil, gas, money, isn't it?
It's crazy. It's really lunatic, because oil and gas, I make a bold prediction, in 10 years, if we don't blow up the entire world, which is a distinct possibility, these lunatics in the Pentagon these days, the neocons, neoconservatives, but excuse my blunt French, but if we don't, I think in 10 years, oil as a fuel for the world's economy is going to become a dinosaur relic, and we are going to go to advanced lithium-ion batteries and
sure.
different modes of clean energy transportation. So, you know, the only thing that prevents it is the power of big oil, special interest groups that are tied into the Pentagon. The big oil and the Pentagon are almost indistinguishable in the post-World War II period. Every place you look that there's a war, it's usually oil or gas that's behind it, or to deny China or someone else that oil and gas, such as South Sudan a few years ago.
William, we just had an Afghan thug who is now a citizen of the United States. Used a couple bombs, 29 people injured, no fatalities. He's been shot and wounded himself. His father claims he was not a Boy Scout, that he had stabbed his brother, pushed his mother around. But he had gone to Afghanistan and Pakistan and came back again. And everybody said that they saw a difference in his personality when he came back. What the heck is going on with these people who are in the country right now who have this strange ideology? What are we going to do with them?
Well, this is a severe security problem. It's the blowback. That's why I call the title of my book, The Lost Hegemon. The CIA had the brilliant idea decades ago, back in the 50s, that they could instrumentalize the way the Nazis had instrumentalized the fanatical wing of Islam to create holy war and kill communists or infidels or whoever they point these psychopaths in the direction of. And this thing has now turned into a Frankenstein monster that is out of control. And that Washington, I don't think the Pentagon knows its left hand from its right anymore. And certainly we're not fighting wars out of principle to make the world safe for democracy or for anything. You show me one of these recent wars since Hillary started the Arab Spring that has brought anything good for anybody.
Oh, even Vietnam. Let's go back to Vietnam. That was a disaster.
Absolutely. Catastrophe.
It costs 50,000.
America doesn't win wars, so you have to question why we always make them. I think people are getting sick of these wars that politicians in Washington seem to love to make to feed the appetite of the military-industrial complex. I wrote a piece recently, George, taking direct quotes from the website of the Inspector General of the U.S. Department of Defense, that the Department of the Army, only one branch of our services, has $6.5 trillion that they cannot account for with a paper
exactly.
trail.
Yeah.
The Pentagon has never in its history been audited independently. Finally, Congress got so upset they passed a law demanding an independent audit by 2017. They're not going to make it. They're not going to do it. They're just throwing their nose up and say, we're so powerful, we elect congressmen, the military industry. And that's what Eisenhower warned about in his farewell speech in 1961.
That's
he
right.
certainly knew because he was commander-in-chief in Europe during World War II.
Let's talk a little bit about China. You've had some experience with China. China's banking system seems to be in trouble these days. What happens, William, if China economically takes that punch and gets knocked out?
China, I've been to China now since 2008 about 14 or 15 times, and all over China. I've presentation of my books in different universities, meetings with different groups of people and so forth. So I have a certain sense of China. They are not going to go under in the same way that the subprime crisis in 2007 pulled the plug on a whole pyramid of toxic waste in the U.S. Banking system. There is a lot of debt in the Chinese banking structure, but one thing is different about China. It's not a freely convertible currency yet, and the Central Bank of China still has control on the state banks. So they can direct the credit. They're learning. Keep in mind, they were a third world country, or even
less than that,
30 years ago. And I was in Xi'an, X-I-A-N as it's spelled, the original start of the Chinese Silk Road. My book that just came out in China is about the Silk Road and the economic benefits for Eurasia and for the world, really. And I had never been to Xi'an before. It's smack in the middle of this landmass called China. And I was shocked to find a bustling city of 10 million people, skyscrapers. They have a special economic zone for IT, for, you know, high tech, and traffic jams, the whole nine yards. And you have this all over China. But now what China is doing, and this is the optimistic point on the economy, while we in the West are destroying everywhere, destroying in Syria, destroying across the Middle East, destroying in Ukraine to try to break off connection between Russia and Germany mainly, and their economies, while we are destroying in the West, the East is building, and Russia and China are cooperating on building high-speed rail infrastructure, deep water ports, so that the trade flows can flow much more efficiently. China also is building this network of high-speed railways. It's called the One Bridge, One Belt, mm-hmm. by the Chinese, or the New Economic Silk Road. They're building this across Eurasia into Kazakhstan, into Iran now, into Russia, and beyond, right up to Bremen in Germany. If the Europeans are intelligent enough to take the advantage of this, which they until now have been silent about. So what this is going to do is to build new markets. You know, markets aren't something free. This Milton Friedman myth that there's something called a free market that George Soros likes to promote and his pals while they loot countries like Brazil and Eastern Europe. The market is something made by man. It's a creation, and it has an economic reality that is shaped by the kinds of infrastructure. And the Chinese have announced publicly they plan to build rail lines that will go where there are known huge gold reserves in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, in these Central Asian republics that used to be part of the Soviet Union. During the Soviet time, gold was not interesting for the Soviet system because they had a command economy. They thought it was a Western capitalist relic, so they kind of ignored it. They had gold reserves, but they ignored it. And now, because their priorities were defense and not...
Now it's gold, gold, gold. William, hang with us. We're going to take this break at the top of the hour. We're coming back for more, and we're opening up the phone lines.